Well, that's a good word. Good word and song. Call your attention to Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2. We'll finish this chapter tonight. This is one of the first encounters that Nebuchadnezzar will have with Daniel's God. And I think that as you see this tonight, that one of the things that you'll easily recognize is that Nebuchadnezzar, when he meets Daniel's God, there's a humility that comes over him. Now, that's an astounding thing because he's a pagan. He has probably been looked upon as a deity himself. But yet, when what happened last week was concluded, and of course, what happened last week immediately after it was concluded in our story, but last week was when we touched on it. But immediately after Daniel had revealed the dream and he had given the interpretation thereof, what you have is you have Nebuchadnezzar and he humbles himself. And so last week we looked at verse 31 through verse 45, and we talked about the great image that Daniel was telling him about. And of course you remember that the gold head, it was representative of Babylon. The silver chest and arms were symbolic of the Medo-Persian Empire that basically in 539 BC defeated the Babylonians. Then the third world empire was the Grecian Empire, and that was represented by the bronze midsection and thighs. The iron legs, of course, represented Rome and the Roman Empire. And the last of the empires that we saw, it had to do with the feet. They were a mixture of iron and clay. And of course, those two things do not mix well. In that mixture, there is a fragility. There is a lack of bonding. There's nothing that's going to weld that together. And so you've got those empires that are listed. Now, we saw that there is another world empire that's going to take place. And what that is that is a stone that comes out of heaven. And I don't think that the stone kingdom has happened yet. Now, there are people in Christianity that believe that the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom that Jesus is going to rule over, is already begun. They say that kingdom began when Jesus came as a baby in Bethlehem. The problem with that is that I don't think that the text really teaches that. I've got several reasons that I wanted to give you tonight before I get into the text, which is verse 46 through 49. But I think that if we will just simply take the Bible at face value, you'll have to realize that a position of an amillennial person or a postmillennial person, you have to do a little, I guess, spiritual gymnastics to get to the positions that they hold to. And so as I was thinking about it this afternoon, I want you to just kind of notice about four things before I get into the text tonight. Why do I think that my position, the premillennial position, why do I think that that's right? Well, first of all, I want you to notice in verse 34, it says, Thou sawest till a stone was cut without hands out of heaven, which smote the image upon its feet that were of iron and clay, and break them in pieces. So what you have a destruction of the feet and the toes that are made of the iron and the clay, and their destruction is very sudden. It's very violent. If the kingdom of the stone begun during the first time Jesus came, it's been going on for a little less than 2,000 years. Well, that's not sudden. That's not violent. But yet that's exactly the picture that is given to us in verse 34. And so I hold to the fact that this has not happened yet, because there has not been that violent destruction. Look at the second thing I want you to look at, and this is going to be in the latter part of verse 35. The stone kingdom, and by the way, the stone is Christ. And so Christ's kingdom only happens after the image is completely destroyed. The kingdom of man is over. And if you look at the chronological order of what has taken place in the text that we have covered thus far, we find that the chronology of it is that there is a total destruction of the Gentile nations. Look with me at verse 35. After we close verse 34, it talked about that the iron and the clay, and it broke them in pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold. All of those are represented by those nations that I mentioned: Rome, Greece, Medo-Persia, Babylon. All four of those are listed in verse 35, and you have in verse 34, in the first part of 35, the clay and the iron. And what happened to all of these? The clay, the iron, the brass, the silver, and the gold. What happened? It says that they were broken into pieces together, and they became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away. In other words, they were gone. You don't find them anymore. And it says, and the stone, there's Christ, that smote the image became a great mountain. It's not a great mountain yet. It became a great mountain when the destruction took place. All right? And so it became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Number three, if this kingdom is in existence, then what we find is, that's maybe not the way I want to say it. If this kingdom was not in existence when Jesus was born, all right? That's the best way to say it. When you think about who was in charge when Jesus was born in Bethlehem, who was the world power? Rome, all right? You had Caesar Augustus, and what did he say? He sent out a decree that all the world should be taxed, that everybody went into their own country. We've read that story, our whole lives at Christmas. So you've got a Caesar Augustus. He is the Caesar. He is the leader of Rome. We don't find anything that's necessarily weak about Rome. We don't find that the feet and those toes that have clay mixed with it, we don't find that at all. And so from a literal standpoint, if I look at this, I just simply say, well, that iron clay kingdom was not in existence when the baby Jesus was born. So the stone coming has got to be something besides that first time that he came. Does that make sense logically? I think it does. And I hope that I've not confused you by saying that. I hope that you understand that he was a baby when Rome, not the iron and the clay mixed. Number four, all the kingdoms that we have looked at, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, All four of those are political in nature. Can we all agree that Nebuchadnezzar is a historical figure? Yeah. We can look at the Medo-Persians, and what do we have? We have Cyrus the Persian, we have Darius the Mede, and you've got those men that are historical figures. I don't think there's anybody here that would deny that there was a man that lived in history named Alexander the Great. He was the one that was in charge of the Grecian Empire. And then, of course, we know about the Roman Empire. We know that that it became the strongest of all militaries at that time. There'd never been any that could match the strength or even the willpower, I don't think, of the Romans. What do we have? We've got those Caesars. We've got Julius Caesar. You've got Augustus Caesar. And you've got all of those strong men. And after they stopped being Caesars and they became emperors, you've got all of those men. They're historical figures. We can look on the internet any day you want to look it up, and you can see the leaders of Rome. You can look at people like Constantine. You can look at people like Decius. You can look at people like Nero. You can look at all of these various emperors and the Caesars, and they're all historical features. And so they are literal people. They were political in nature. And yet the postmillennial and the amillennial, they have a tendency to say, well, the other kingdom is spiritual. Well, that smacks in the face of something that's not rational. If the first four are literal and were actual people, why is it that the coming kingdom, which is going to be iron mixed with clay, why would that not be literal people? And then why would the stone that is cut without hands and it comes and it smashes that kingdom, and then that stone itself is set up and it's going to rule forever, why would that not be literal? I don't think that you get to be able to just change horses because of what you want. I think you've got to be consistent with what the text says. And the best position when you read this and you think about it from a logical standpoint, and when you take it from a literal standpoint, there's coming a day when that stone is going to come out of heaven and it's going to smash that revived Roman Empire, and it's going to grind it in pieces, and it's ultimately going to grind every influence of all of those ancient civilizations, whether it be the Roman influence, the Greek influence, the Persian influence, or the Babylonian influence. It's going to grind all of that, and the wind is going to blow it away just like the chaff off of a threshing floor. And so, with that in mind, I want you to just remember, we're talking about something that is literally going to happen. We're not talking about something out there in the Ethernet or something that's esoteric. We're talking about a literal kingdom that Jesus is going to set up. I believe that there's coming a time when Jesus is going to rule and reign, and he's going to do it for 1,000 years, and then ultimately he's going to rule into all of eternity. But there is a millennial reign of Christ, which I believe is literal. I believe it's going to be 1,000 years because the Bible uses the word 1,000 years, or the words 1,000 years. And so tonight we're going to pick up in verse 46, but I just wanted to nail that down for you at the beginning of the message tonight. Now, the title of the message is Beginning to See God. I've titled that message, the message that way, because I really believe that there's going to be two or three instances in the life of Nebuchadnezzar where that God literally shows himself mighty in his life. It would not surprise me when I get to heaven if Nebuchadnezzar isn't there. I have a lot of people that I really doubt. I don't think there's a king in all of divided Israel when they had the northern and the southern divisions, I don't think there was a single king in the north that was an Old Testament saint. Not all the ones in Judah, the southern part, were Old Testament saints. Now you had people like good king, you know, Josiah, and you had guys like Hezekiah. You had those types of men. They loved the Lord. But I think that of all of the pagans that you've got in the Old Testament, I can think of a handful, maybe people like Rahab. She was a pagan, but she met Christ. Ruth, she was a Moabitess, which was a pagan, and she met Jehovah. But it wouldn't surprise me at all if Nebuchadnezzar was not in glory at this moment. And the reason that I say that is because of the instances that he has to come in contact with Jehovah. And the first time that happens is tonight. And so I want us to look, number one, I want you to look at Daniel's success. Then the king Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face. Now remember what's just happened. Daniel has just told him the dream. Nobody else could do it. He's just told him the interpretation that nobody else could come up with. And he says, this dream is genuine, it's certain, and the interpretation thereof, sure. In other words, you can take this to the bank. And the king is so moved by this that we see his behavior when it says he fell on his face, he worshiped Daniel. Now let that sink in for a moment. You've got a young man that's 17, 18 years old. He's telling the king something that no other wise man could tell him. And so he is falling down before this kid. And he is worshiping, he is giving homage, he's paying honor to Daniel. And when I see this, you keep reading, it says, he commanded that they should offer an oblation. Now, when we use the word oblation today, we usually mean it in reference to some type of heart procedure where they're going to do an ablation of the heart, where they'll go in and they'll shock the heart to try to kill a nerve or to shock it back into some type of rhythm. But an oblation is like a sacrifice. And so the king commands, he says, I want you to make a sacrifice to Daniel. This young man is so great, we're going to give him honor. We're going to give him everything that a young boy could want. I mean, you talk about signing bonuses. The second time Daniel meets the king, he wows him so much. Now, remember the first time he met him, he simply said, don't be so hasty. The second time he meets him, he tells him everything that the king is either forgotten or is not really known the interpretation. Maybe he remembered the dream, maybe he didn't. It's a difference in thought on that. But you've got Nebuchadnezzar, and he is commanding all of this oblation. And so Daniel is honored. When I see the success that he has had, I always think back, well, if I were successful like that, would I be as, I guess, conscientious as Daniel has been? We'll see more of that here in just a moment. But I'm telling you, I got a feeling that there was relief that was found among the wise men. You say, why do you think there was relief? Well, what was the command that he had given? I want you to kill the wise men because they couldn't tell me the dream nor the interpretation. And I personally think that they had already begun killing some of them until Daniel said, wait a minute, I can do this. And then there was probably a halt put to it. But there were probably some men that had already lost their lives, those that were maybe closest to the king. He might have said, you can't do it, off with his head. And so we see in verse 46, we see that there is a success that Daniel has had when nobody else could do it. Well, if you begin to look at verse number 48, you'll see a second thing tonight. You'll see that there's some rewards that are given. Some rewards. Gifts, honor, power, they're all headed Daniel's way. Well, what does it tell us? Well, look at verse 48 with me. We'll come back to 47 in just a moment. Then the king made Daniel a great man. Well, probably in God's eyes, he was already great. But now he is basically given a great position by Nebuchadnezzar. And sometimes when people are given great positions, people give many gifts. If you remember the story, I alluded to it not long ago when I was giving my thoughts about the position that we hold as being premillennial. You think about the time in which the wise men, the magi, came to Jesus. What did they come bearing? They came bearing gifts. When you would visit someone in ancient times, you would usually take a gift. Some of you have visited us in our home, and some of you ladies have brought my wife flowers, or you've brought a cake, or you've bought something and we just want to give this to you. Why is that? Because you love us? Because you want to show some form of respect? And we do that when we go visit a home. I can't tell you the number of times that my wife says, well, we need to stop at the store. And I'm like, well, why? Well, because I've got to pick this gift up. Well, what kind of gift? Well, it doesn't have to be much, but it's got to be a gift. And she may stop and get some type of scented candle that maybe she knows the lady loves to smell. You know, or she may buy a bouquet of flowers and take those. But the reason that she does that is because she wants to honor the people that we're going to see. Now, we don't do that every time, and it's not done to us every time. But I'm telling you, there are times that we do those types of things. Why? Because we consider it to be a great honor to be in their presence. And so this man has now been elevated. He is a great man. And now they're bringing gifts to him. Why? Because he could do something that nobody else could do. There wasn't one single man among the wise men. Not one that could do what Daniel did. And Nebuchadnezzar knew that. And so you've got this young boy that is 17, 18 years old. And he is put up on a pedestal. And he is called great. And when the king calls you great, you better believe it, other people are going to be calling you great. They're bringing gifts to him. And so we see that he is rewarded with wealth. Not only that, but notice the second thing. It says that Nebuchadnezzar made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon. Now let that sink in for a moment. There were many, many provinces in Babylon. Just visualize ancient Babylon like the United States. We have 50 states that make up the United States. We have a president that is over in a federal capacity, those states. But each of those states have a governor. So imagine Daniel being placed over all the states or all the provinces. Why? Because of his wisdom, because of his abilities. Doesn't matter about his age. There are some people that are wise beyond their years. And there are some people that ought to be wise, but they're fools in their later years. You have people that make good decisions when they're young, sometimes, not often. And then you have people that make bad decisions sometimes, no matter how old they get. I've known of people that were a lot older than me, and I'm thinking, how can they make that decision? But yet they make it, and they have more trouble. And so you've got Daniel, and he is placed now in a position that is over all the provinces. Now, I don't think that this is a problem for the wise men. Not now. And the reason that I don't think it's a problem for the wise men right now is because he just saved their life. They're probably glad that kid came along. They're probably thinking, hey, I'm not dying today. Whereas they had already tried to maybe put their affairs in order before Daniel shows up. But when he gives the dream and the interpretation, all of a sudden, they breathe a sigh of relief. And so he is over the whole province. But then there's a third thing. It says that he is made the chief of the governors over all the wise men of Babylon. So not only is he higher than governors, even those that have high positions of authority, the astrologers, the magicians, the Chaldeans, the sorcerers, all of those, he is in charge of them. This will change, but right now they're happy with him. Later on, there's going to be some problems and there's going to be some people, and they begin to try to undermine him. They'll begin to give advice. That advice will be taken, and when that advice is taken, Daniel will not adhere to it. But right now, everybody's on board with this young man. There's no resentment. This close call with death is going to be something that they will remember for a short time, but it won't be long before they'll forget all about it. When I think about that, I think about our own Christian life, how that God will come through and we'll be praising God. We'll be as excited as we can be. God met this need. God answered that prayer. And then 3 months from now, it's like, where's God at? We have short memories. These men are going to have some short memories. But for right now, Daniel is rewarded. Now, let me close with the last point. And this is what I'm calling Daniel's humility. Daniel's humility. Daniel has not changed one iota. From the time that he was taken captive in 605 BC. Right now, we're talking, it's probably somewhere around 602. Possibly 601, depending on how you count the reign. We covered that back when we began, when it talked about in the second year of King Nebuchadnezzar, whether it was an ascension year or whether you count part of the year as a whole year. The Jews count a partial year as a whole year. The Gentiles, they do not. If you didn't serve for the whole year, then you only got partial credit, and they called it the ascension year. And so we see that from the time that he was captured, whether it was not eating the king's food, whether it was just subsisting on vegetables, he and his buddies, they were found better. As a matter of fact, it says at the end of chapter 1, they were 10 times better. Now, whether that's just a figure of speech or if it's literal, I don't know, but I know that he was head and shoulders above everybody else that had gone through that three-year program. And so we see that Daniel has not changed. Now, what did they try to do for him in verse 46? They tried to make oblation or make a sacrifice and to burn incense for him. But it seems as though, it's not spoken, but it seems as though that Daniel goes, no, 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 don't do that. Don't do that. You say, well, where do you get that? Look with me at verse 47. Daniel is not said to have said anything in verse 46, but listen to the response in verse 47 to the king. The king answered unto Daniel and said, of a truth it is. In other words, why would the king say that had not Daniel said something to him? I think that what you see is that you see Daniel, he is happy about receiving the honor, but he's giving God the glory. Do you see that in verse 47 when the king answers what we do not read in verse 46? I think that if you really think it through, you'll see that. It says, the king answered unto Daniel. So that answering evidently was something that Daniel had spoken. And so he says, of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods. Now that's an astounding statement. You remember in those ancient times, people would carry the banners of their God into battle with them. And if you prevailed, that meant that your God was stronger than your enemy's God. What had Nebuchadnezzar done when he rolled in to Jerusalem? He went into the temple and he took the vessels of the temple. That was his booty. He was taking anything of value. He was stripping the land, and part of that stripping included the vessels of the temple. You know what that said to Nebuchadnezzar? The Jews' God's useless. You can't stop me from doing anything. That's what he thought in 605. But now, maybe he's having second thoughts, because he's talking about Daniel's God, and he says, well, it is true that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings. Why did he use that phrase, Lord of kings? Because Daniel had already told him that you are the head of gold and that God put you there. And so he is now saying that your God is the greatest God, your Lord. He sets up kings. He is a revealer of the secrets, seeing thou couldest reveal this secret. In other words, Daniel has told him, God's the one that's done this. If you wonder where he's done that, look back with me at verse 28. In verse 28, what does Daniel say? But there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Thy dream and thy visions upon thy head or upon thy bed are these. So he tells him there's a God in heaven that does this. Verse 30, but as for me, this secret is not revealed unto me for any wisdom that I have more than any living. In other words, I'm no smarter than anybody else. It's God that's doing it. And so we see that there is a humility that Daniel has done. And in his heart, I believe that it's all about serving the Lord. I believe that Daniel has passed what we would call the prosperity test. And that is a hard test to pass. Can I tell you that in my own life, and I wouldn't bet money, but I'd bet maybe a donut, that in your life, when things are going great and you got money in the bank, and the kids are all healthy, and your job's going well, your cars are in good shape, the mortgage is current, maybe ahead, you got all these things going, what does it matter if I, you know, miss church a little bit? What does it matter if I don't read my Bible as faithfully as I ought to? What does it matter if I don't really have a prayer time? Yeah, I'm doing good. But you let the baby get sick. You let an unexpected bill come in that you don't have the money to pay for. You haven't got the money to pay for it. Your boss says, I want to talk to you on Monday morning. It's really important. And all weekend, you're anxious about it. When things are prosperous, we don't always live as close to the Lord as we ought to. Sometimes we have a tendency to get a little closer to the Lord when we're in trouble. Doug referenced that before he sang tonight. Talked about the lady that put on Facebook that, that people in Ukraine went to church. Can you remember a time about 21 years ago that happened here? 9/11. The Sunday after 9/11, churches were packed. People were in church. People were calling out to God. But it was short-lived. It was short-lived. You know, the tension wore off. The anxiousness wore off. You know, we didn't have any more buildings go down. You know, I mean, after all, I mean, we started getting real serious about security and things calmed down a little bit. But when we didn't know, when there was uncertainty, we were going before the throne of God regularly. And so, the times that we are in prosperity, it ought not change us, but often it does. But it did not change Daniel. It did not matter if he was a captive as a 15-year-old boy, if they put him in the Chaldean college for 3 years and tried to feed him with pagan foods, and he was said, I'll be healthier if you'll just let me eat what I want. And so he lived his life, whether it was under pressure or in prosperity, he lived it the same way. And we'll see that, just as we'll see Nebuchadnezzar on another occasion or two, how that he will submit and humble himself before Jehovah. You see Daniel living his life. When they say you can't pray, he does it just as he has done in the past. He opens his windows and he prays toward Jerusalem. Why does he do that? Because he was consistent as a young man and he was consistent as an old man. We need to remember that when prosperity comes, you and I, we're in a danger spot. We need to take Daniel's advice. When we are prosperous, we ought to want others to be prosperous with us. If you'll read verse 49, you can do that when you get home if you want to. Well, it's up on the screen now. Daniel requests of Nebuchadnezzar something. He said, I want you to let Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, I want you to give them a position of prominence. Because you see, they helped me pray. Don't you remember that verse that we talked about where it says that we talk to the Lord of heaven? It was we. He was of the mindset, it's not just about me, it's about taking somebody with me. I never knew much about him because I was only probably 19 at the time. But there was a congressman from Texas, I think his name was Wright Patman. He had served a long time. He began in 1929 in one of the districts of Texas. And he served until 1976. And when he died, they were interviewing some of the people in his district. And there were some of the ladies, and they had gotten together, and evidently they were just talking amongst themselves about how great this man was and how that he had helped them. And one of the ladies made this statement: "He rose up mighty high, and he took us all with him." You see, he had been elected at the Depression time. And all of these women, they were struggling in his district. Their families were struggling. But he helped them get through that depression as their congressman. And he was elected, I think it was for 36 consecutive terms. And their statement was, "He rose up mighty high, and he brought us with him." That's what Daniel did. He brought his buddies with him. You say, are they special too? Yes, they are. We'll get to that somewhere down the road. Let's stand together.